This is a CBC podcast. With great new shows, podcasts, concerts on demand, and internet music channels, there are so many ways to enjoy the new CBC Radio 2. Go to cbc.ca/radio2 for a music mix you won't hear anywhere else. CBC Radio 2. Everywhere music takes you.
From the King's Playhouse in Georgetown, Prince Edward Island, it's the Vinyl Cafe with Stuart MacLean.
Thank you so very much. That's very kind. I feel the same way myself. I'm happy to be here, though I feel I should tell you that, like any good Islander, I took my sweet island time getting here to Georgetown. I got here to the island a week ago. We picked up a car at the airport, and, well, we got right into the island spirit. I'm not talking about moonshine. Although I do have a bottle of Lime Ricky backstage. You know what I mean. I'm talking about taking my time. I've been loafing since I arrived, dawdling, taking the back roads. And you know what? I couldn't be happier. It is wonderful to be back on this wonderful island. When we picked up our car at the airport, we headed east, over the gentle rolling hills, past fields as red as rust, the rows of potatoes lined up like corduroy, through the little villages of Cardigan and Mount Stewart, St. Margaret's and North Lake, around the blueberry fields and along the ocean, which kept popping up whatever which road we took. We have been wandering. And during our wanders, we've stood underneath, right underneath, the 10 white windmills on the eastern tip and listened to their giant blades cutting through the sky like scissors. We've admired the beach at Rock Barra and the bridge at Basin Head, where the kids jump into adulthood when they're finally brave enough to jump into the swiftly moving Basin Head Run. And we took in a show at the Trailside Inn, walked along the Confederation Trail, stood on the dock in North Lake, where hundreds of people gather on a summer afternoon to cheer any boat that plows down the channel with a bluefin tuna on its deck. We visited Johnny Flynn's oyster farm, where we'd been promised we'd find the soft, salty taste of the best oysters in the country. We weren't disappointed. I have been wandering for a week, and this is what I've learned. There are mosquitoes here big enough to cast shadows. When we first arrived, we thought all those friendly-looking people standing by the roadside were waving at us. Now we know better. It's not that PEI is so friendly. It's under attack. And what I want to know is, what were those bugs feeding on before I got here? I have learned living on an island often means letting nature have its way, and it's not just in the summer. It's in the winter, too, especially in the winter. I've learned that everybody expects to go without power for a few days every winter if they live on PEI. What else have I learned? Well, I've learned that the largest lobster processing plant in the world is just down the road a piece. But I've also learned that 70% of the island's businesses employ less than 5 people. And I wasn't surprised to learn that, because this is a corner of the world that is human in scale in every way. I've spoken to a lot of people this week, and I've been asking them what I should say about this place, and time again, they have told me exactly the same thing. PEI, they've told me, is all about the people. First few times I heard that, I thought to myself, that sounds like something you'd say to a guy who comes from away. But I think it's true. or it's been true for me at least, I visited a lot of kitchens this week, and I felt at home in all of them. Earlier this week, I found myself in Fortune Bay. We were having dinner with our friend Michael Smith, the chef. Sitting right there tonight, down up in front. "Is there anything you don't like to eat?" he asked as he squeezed a lemon into a salad he was throwing together. "Well, there's nothing I don't like," I said. "Ah," said Michael, making a dash for his wall of spices. "That sounds like a challenge." Then he said, "Where are my crickets?" "I didn't take your crickets," said Michael's wife, Rachel. They might be down in your office." "Don't look so worried," said Becky, an organic farmer and, like me, a dinner guest that night. "The crickets aren't so bad, though their tiny little feet can get caught in your teeth." That was at the beginning of the week. By the end of the week, I felt so at home I was throwing parties myself in my own little motel kitchen. Last night, the mayor of Georgetown showed up at my place with a bucket of lobsters, and we threw together some salad and vegetables, and he and some of the other folks I have met in town sat around my kitchen table exchanging stories and passing around a bottle of Lime Ricky. Kidding. People don't put on airs here. It's comfortable. There are only 4 movie theaters on the island. This is the kind of place where you have to make your own fun. So the kids play baseball or fall off the wharf. And the teens have beach parties. And everybody else goes to fundraisers. People in PEI gather up in kitchens and community halls at the slightest provocation. Everyone is a neighbor. Doesn't matter whether they live next door and have unexpected medical expenses or on the other side of the world and have suffered through a tsunami. Last Tuesday night, I found myself sitting by the wood stove in Margie Carmichael's kitchen. Margie's a 4th-generation Islander. "I may not be best friends with my neighbor," said Margie, "but we look out for each other. We mind each other's business." You laugh, but maybe that's why it feels so safe here. Like most Islanders, Margie has sat through her share of kitchen parties, and she can play a tune or two. She's learned from her neighbors. As the night wore on, she pulled out a guitar and did just that. And I thought Margie's song summed up this place as well as I ever could. As we were saying goodnight, I asked her if she'd mind playing a couple of her songs for a few friends of mine. Ladies and gentlemen, will you please welcome, for her international radio debut, Margie Carmichael.
Thank you, Stuart. Hi, everybody. I hope you'll help me sing in the chorus of this song. Some of you may have heard it. On the red dirt road, the red dirt road, on the red dirt road. On the red dirt road, the red dirt road, on the red dirt road. Oh, the red dirt road wasn't easy traveling, especially early in the spring. Mud to the belly made many turn back and forget about planning anything. People got the horses out and graded it themselves, they didn't need a road machine. They didn't need politicians to improve the conditions, and the grass grew green. On the red dirt road, the red dirt road, on the red dirt road. Riding to the Cayleys, dropping in on the neighbor's church on Sunday too. Never made strangers of the people next door like these times tend to do. The doctor came by if anyone was sick, and half the time he never got a cent. Oh yeah, the red dirt road made neighbors of us all. We were all content on the red dirt road. The red dirt road, on the red dirt road. Then the auto was invented and the horses were tormented, and everybody started giving in. Soon a lot of them were driving fancy little rigs, and they were sporting their expensive little grins. They widened all the ruts, they raised a lot of dust, and it settled on the wagon and the sleigh. And when the red dirt road wasn't coping with the load, they paved it away. Oh, I grew up on a red dirt road, my feet got tough on a red dirt road, I fell in love on a red dirt road, on a red dirt road, a red dirt road, on a red dirt road, on a red dirt road, a red dirt road, on a red dirt road.
Carmichael. We met Margie at the Trailside Inn the very first night we got here. She was our waitress. That was Margie's tune, Red Dirt Road. And unless you know Margie, the only way you can hear that again would be to go to the Vinyl Cafe website and download our podcast, and then you can listen as often as you like. Time now for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. Well, you know how this part works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true stories and they have to be short, but after that, well, after that, it's up to you. We'll read everything you send us, and we'll read some of our favorites on the radio. If we read yours on the radio, we'll send you a signed copy of our latest book, Secrets from the Vinyl Cafe. Today's letter comes from Bev Knutson-Shaw of Vulcan, Alberta. Dear Stuart, writes Bev, my paternal grandfather, Leon Founds, is from Hopewell Cape, New Brunswick. His forefathers were loyalists. When returning home after the First World War, my grandfather was given land in Alberta, where he farmed, married, and had a family. He never returned east. As a result, my mother never met much of her extended family. As she has aged, Mom has developed a deep desire to connect with her Founds family in the East. So a few years back, we decided to celebrate our birthdays by making a trip east to Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and Prince Edward Island. I wanted to visit two dear friends, but Mom, with her list of long-lost relatives, had her own agenda. Reluctantly, I went along with her plan to look up people we didn't know, but who shared the same last name. We met many interesting Founds people who were happy to meet us. By the end of the vacation, Mom had managed to contact most of the people on her list, but she still had one thing to do. She'd been told that there was a Founds graveyard that had been dug up while they were constructing the Fundy Trail Parkway near St. Martin's in New Brunswick. She wanted to visit it. So, armed with some interesting directions and a questionable map, we headed out on a Sunday afternoon. It was a dreary, rainy day, and I really didn't feel like heading into the forest to search for a graveyard. But my mom was adamant. We drove through St. Martin's until the road ended, and when it did, we looked for the landmark that we had been given, a tree beside a rock. As you can imagine, it took a moment or two to find it, but we did, and we headed into the forest. The directions, which by now were dripping wet, said to look for an old stone fence. We looked and looked and looked some more. We must have been out there for over an hour. We were soaked to the skin, and our map was ruined. Finally, after wandering around in circles, we located a pile of stones that one would barely recognize as a fence. The instruction said to follow the wall until you get to a big tree. It would be here that we would find the gravestones. The trouble is, we didn't know which end of the fence we were at, or if we were even at the end of the fence. We picked a direction and started walking. Sometimes it seemed as though the stones had ended, and then after a few steps, they'd begin again. Eventually, we got to what we believed was the end of the fence. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a piece of orange surveyor's tape. It was off in the trees in the distance, and it was here that we found them, a group of six or seven graves. They were gravestones from the Founds and the Melvin family. The park workers had set the stones up against a tree and put a tape around them. One of those stones was from the very first Founds to come to Canada, William Founds, a loyalist who was born in 1750 and died in 1846. William and his wife Isabel. These were my first Canadian ancestors. It was amazing to think about these people, who they were and what their lives were like. We felt like we had discovered the new world. The light was fading fast. We took a few photos and then we headed out in another direction. We discovered, as Murphy's Law would have it, that we were only 5 minutes from the main road. It was a good day. A day that had started out dim and dreary had become the highlight of that trip. A connection to my past. The graves and the land that they're on were reconsecrated in 2001. That story comes to us from Bev Knutson-Shaw of Vulcan, Alberta. So it's my pleasure now to introduce our next musical guest, someone who I've wanted to have on the show since the first time I heard her sing. Ladies and gentlemen, will you please welcome Catherine McClellan. Catherine's going to sing a song that she wrote for her late father, someone you all know, Island songwriter Gene McClellan. And those of you from away, you'll know his work. Gene wrote songs like Snowbird and Put Your Hand in the Hand. And Catherine said she wrote this song as a sort of letter to her late father, as a way of telling him all the things that she'd like to tell him, but can't. Catherine McClellan.
Truth. somehow, or to walk me down that aisle. But I will not be the first you will miss. Giving birth will be your seventh grandchild. It's been a long time. It's been a long, long time. Got your old 45s on the turntable while I go thumbing through those pages. All those old photographs of days we can't get back. Still, the people sing your praises. It's been a long time. It's been a long, long time. Wish you could meet all the ones that we've loved. Still they see you through the past. But I cannot describe just the way that you smiled or the beauty of your laugh. Well, it's been a long time. It's been a long time. Thank you.
Here's a different kind of song. I guess it's a song called A Place You Don't Call Yours, and it's about trying to find a place that I can call mine that doesn't belong to my ex, I guess. But I've given up, so I'm just going to move home. Well, it's been a very long year since you left me behind. I'm paying for things I didn't do all the time. I'm paying in feelings I can't quite explain. Every time I'm in another town where they know your name. Well, your face is taped up to lampposts and walls. Your music's playing in cafes and halls. And they all adore you, oh, that's how it seems. And I just keep hoping that I'll wake from this dream. Sackville is too small, Toronto too large. Halifax, for 18 years you've had her heart. And so I'll keep wandering until I can find a place that you don't.
don't call yours, that I can call mine. All the girls who have loved you, all the ones that you will, all the bands that play your songs, they haunt me still. But when will I be free of all of these thoughts? You seem to be everywhere, and I seem to be caught. Well, Sackville is too small, Toronto too large, Halifax for 18 years you've had her heart. And so I'll keep wandering until I can find a place that you don't call yours, that I can call mine. Yeah, so I'll keep wandering until I can find a place that you don't call yours, that I can call mine.
Thank you.
Catherine McClellan. On the last Saturday in March, a gray and woolly day, if there ever was one, Sandy Rutledge of Rutledge's Hardware Store on River Street in Big Narrows, Cape Breton, stayed after everyone else had left for the day so he could organize the hardware store's first ever window display. Sandy graduated from business school last year, the first in his family to go to university. Ever since, he's been bugging his father to let him make some changes. Willard Rutledge finally relented. Sandy stayed late, and by Monday lunch, pretty much everyone had heard about Rutledge's new front window. People were making trips to town just to check it out. What Sandy did was clean out the mess of doorbells, the bags of birdseed, the towers of toasters and kettles that accumulated in the front window over the last 74 years. And he replaced the entire jumble with a solitary mannequin. It, or more to the point, she, was wearing a bridal gown. Sandy picked up the mannequin and the gown secondhand from a shop in Sydney. The idea, it being just a few weeks until spring, was to encourage the brides of Big Narrows to register at the hardware store. By the end of the week, much to Sandy's delight, they had two brides. And a third, Becky Michelle of Fletcher's Harbor, wavering under pressure from her fiancé, Cliff, who had wanted a nail gun since he was 7. Dave's mother, Margaret, was one of the last people in town to see the window. Smith Gardner picks Margaret up every Thursday afternoon, and they go to the Elks meat raffle. On Thursday, as they pulled into Kerrigan's parking lot, Smith said, "Do you want to see the window?" Margaret said, "Sure." As Margaret peered at the wedding dress, Smith said, "I wouldn't want to go through that again." Margaret nodded, and then they stood there awkwardly. That was the first time Smith and Margaret talked about marriage. When she got home, Margaret stared in her bathroom mirror. "Uh-oh," she said. It was the middle of April when Smith decided to propose. He drove to Sydney to get the ring. His late wife, Jean, had hated her wedding ring. She said it irritated her finger. Eventually, she took it off and wore the ring around her neck on a chain. Smith didn't want Margaret to hate her ring, so all he bought was a diamond. The jeweler said they could come back together and choose a setting. It was a modest stone. "But it has good color," said the jeweler, holding it up to the light. Smith dropped the bag on the passenger seat of his pickup. He pulled off the road as soon as he crossed the Seal Island Bridge. He shook the diamond into his rough hand, took a deep breath, and held it up in the sun. Didn't look like it had any color to him. Looked as clear as glass. On his way through town, Smith stopped at Kerrigan's and bought a tub of ice cream. Margaret's favorite flavor, maple walnut. He took the ice cream to Margaret's house for Sunday lunch. He set the diamond on top of her ice cream. And then he set the bowl in front of her. He sat waiting, his heart pounding as she picked up her spoon. Margaret polished off the entire bowl and sat back. That was good, she said. Not knowing what to say, Smith didn't say anything. He drove to Sydney the next morning. I want another diamond, he said. A bigger one with more color so it stands out. The jeweler put a blue velvet tray on the counter and showed him the stones. That one, said Smith. But this time, put it in a ring. What kind of setting, asked the jeweler. Comfortable one, said Smith. What size, asked the jeweler. Medium, said Smith. The first warm weekend in May, they went to Ignish to visit Smith's son. On the way home, Smith said, let's go back the long way through the bay, Irish Bay, where Margaret grew up. Margaret almost said, it's getting late. Instead, she said, that'd be nice, Smith. They pulled off the highway at the gas station and came into town at the south end, past the Stinson farm and Dr. Sandberg's old place. It had been dark for an hour when Smith pulled up in front of the house where she grew up. Margaret said, so long ago. Smith said, let's go see if the iris are up. Margaret felt anxious. She didn't know the people who lived there anymore, city people. But Smith was already walking around the front of his pickup. Smith said, there's no one home, just a peek. Against her better instincts, Margaret followed Smith across the damp lawn, the dew chilly on her feet. She was nervous, but she was also intrigued. She heard the click as he slid the gate latch in the darkness, and she followed him into the yard where she and Elizabeth had played when they were girls. It was so strange to be there again. She sighed. Then she smiled at Smith and turned to go. Smith didn't move. Slipping a ring on Margaret's finger under the moon in the garden where she had been a girl and had probably dreamed of such things had seemed like a good idea in the abstract. But here in the garden, it didn't seem like a good idea at all. Smith was feeling lightheaded and woozy. His legs were shaking. Smith? Said Margaret. Smith had slipped the ring out of his pocket. He lurched forward and grabbed Margaret's hand. And Margaret, who hadn't seen the ring, could sense his unsteadiness. But it was his face that gave him away. It was written on his face. It was as clear as day. Smith was about to tell her that he was dying. Oh, Smith, she said. No. No, said Smith. Margaret glanced down and saw the ring for the first time. She started to laugh. Smith had gone over this moment many times in his mind. He had imagined many responses, but never laughter. Margaret said, oh, Smith. But before she could say anything else, a light flicked on upstairs and a window banged open. Smith swore and he tugged her, and Smith and Margaret ran out of the back garden and tumbled into his truck like a pair of teenagers. They ripped down the street, around the corner, and all the way to the church before they stopped. My heart, said Smith, resting his head on the wheel. Margaret waited for him to settle. When he did, she said, Smith Gardner? Did you just ask me to marry you? Smith didn't lift his head. He said, yes. Did you just refuse? And Margaret said, "No, Smith. The ring was too big." So they went back to the jeweler the very next morning and they had it sized. On the way out of the store, Margaret stopped, took it off her finger, and slipped it into her purse. Smith said, "Why'd you do that?" Margaret said, "Smith, people are going to see it if I keep it on my hand." Smith said, "We certainly wouldn't want that." For a week, Margaret didn't tell a soul. She fretted instead. Truth was, the whole thing embarrassed her. In her heart, she wished that she and Smith could do what the young kids do and move in together. After a week of fretting, she picked up the telephone. It was a Sunday afternoon. Smith had already told his kids. She couldn't delay any longer. She had to phone her daughter, Annie, in Halifax, and David. "Hi," she said, "how are you?" She had been working in the garden. She was wearing her gardening slacks and an oversized cardigan that used to belong to her late husband, Charlie. She was standing by the kitchen window. Her hands still had dirt on them. She took a deep breath. She said, "David, I have something to tell you." "You're sick," said Dave. "Worse," said Margaret. "Smith asked me to marry him." Dave shouldn't have been so surprised. He knew that this was coming. Smith had as good as asked his permission that afternoon in the graveyard. When was that anyway? 2 years ago. He shouldn't have been surprised, but he was. So when Margaret blurted it out, Dave was not his best self. Margaret said, "Smith asked me to marry him." And the very first thing Dave said was, "Where will you be buried then?" "There's supposed to be a spot beside Dad." Margaret said, "I honestly hadn't considered that." Dave was as amazed as she was at what had just come out his mouth. He said, I suppose the fact that it doesn't really matter to me where you're buried won't stop you from telling everyone that that was my first reaction." And Margaret said, "Probably not." Dave didn't really want to talk about it, which was fine because neither did she. They talked about her garden instead. And then they said goodbye. When Margaret hung up, she shrugged. It was the first time she'd said it out loud, "I'm getting married." "That wasn't so bad," she said. She waited 5 minutes before she phoned Annie. "Oh my God," said Annie, "where will you be buried?" There was a stunned silence. And then Margaret said, "David called you." And Annie snorted and they both laughed and laughed. When they stopped laughing, Annie said, "Oh, Mom, I'm so happy for you. How did he ask?" And Margaret said, "He asked me under the moon in the garden in Irish Bay." And Annie said, "I want to know every last detail." Now that she'd spoken the words out loud, Margaret figured she might as well keep going. Next morning, she went to Kerrigan's grocery store, knowing that she'd bump into Winnie. Winnie always shopped Monday mornings. They met in front of the lunch meats. Margaret took a deep breath and said offhandedly, "We're thinking about having the reception at the curling club." Winnie said, "What reception?" Margaret said, "Oh, didn't I tell you?" She suspected that would do the trick. And she was right. Everyone in town knew by lunch. And it didn't go as badly as Margaret had imagined. It went worse than she had imagined. When you're 84 years old, you don't want people treating you as if you were cute. Everyone thought it was cute. Everyone thought it was sweet. "Makes me wish you had some sort of problem," she said to Smith as they were walking his dog along the gut. "Couldn't you start drinking or something?" And that was before Bernadette and Winnie were warmed up. That was before Bernadette and Winnie started up about what Margaret should wear. "I don't want it to be a big fancy thing," said Margaret. "I'm not advising a floor-length gown," said Winnie. Bernadette nodded in agreement. In fact, said Winnie, I'd advise against it. You need a proper dress and jacket. I know a lady in Halifax who does a lovely job with seed pearls. They were at the post office. They were in front of the mailboxes. While Winnie was talking, Bernadette had pulled a tape measure out of her purse. Before Margaret knew what was happening, Bernadette was wrapping it around her middle. We are not, said Margaret, pulling the tape measure from her waist, going to Halifax. There is nothing like a wedding to addle people's minds. Especially, it turns out, if those people have spent too much of their recent years planning funerals. As April opened into May, everyone in Big Narrows, everyone of a certain age, that is, was fussing over the first big celebration that had come their way in decades. Patty Ann Madigan called to tell Margaret about a hybrid rose that she had read about in the Reader's Digest. It was named after Diana, the Princess of Wales. It has such a beautiful scent, said Patty Ann, who had never actually smelled one. George McDonnell from the Legion ambushed her in the parking lot at Kerrigan's. We best be nailing down the reception, said George. Lots of other events happening that month. The Sausage Festival is on the 12th, you know. Now, have you been to book on the music now, Margaret? Said Alf MacDonald when he zeroed in on her in front of the roving library. Sid should be home, you know. Alf's son, Sid, who DJs at a hip-hop club in Yarmouth. He'll be in Halifax the week of the wedding, said Alf. He's getting his tattoo worked on. Sid has been slowly adding to his art as he can afford it. When it's finished, his tattoo will cover his entire body and tell the life story of Celine Dion with a lavish wedding scene covering most of his back. Margaret began to dread going out. Wherever she went, there was someone hovering with some sort of unwanted advice. She didn't leave her house for 3 days. On the fourth, she phoned Smith. She said, I can't do this. We can't get married. She expected he would come over and try to talk her out of it, or more to the point, into it. He didn't try to talk her into it. He said, that's okay, I understand. That night, Margaret went up to the attic with a box of winter stuff. She wasn't planning on bringing any summer stuff down, but once she got up there, she began poking around. When she climbed into the far corner, she came face to face with Charlie's uniform from the war. It was hanging on a post. It was wrapped in a plastic dry cleaner's bag. According to the tag, it had last been cleaned in April 1963. There was a shoebox beneath it. She knew what was in it. It was filled with letters Charlie had written her from England. She flicked on an old lamp and sat in its orange glow for the longest time reading those letters. Dear Juan, we arrived here at 7 p.m., and I half thought there might be a wire. It's absurd to think I have only been away for a week. Her eyes flicked to the bottom of the page. Now, my dearest love, I must say good night. It's nearly 12. God bless you, my dear, dear girl. There was a box of photo albums somewhere. When she finished the letters, she took the first photo album and settled it in her lap. Pictures of the kids. David, maybe 5 years old. And there was their first car. It looked so ancient. She ran her finger across the page as if she could reach back through time, as if she could touch the past by touching the little black and white photos, the white borders, the serrated edges. There were titles under each picture, printed in white ink on the black paper in Charlie's hand. Annie at the beach. Hungry Dave. Bath time. She opened the next book. It was her wedding pictures. She slammed it shut. She stood up and started for the stairs, and then she took a deep breath, and she sat down, and she opened the book again. It was past midnight when she left the attic. She drove to Smith's house first thing the next morning. She let herself in through the side door. "I was getting worried," said Smith. "I'm sorry," she said. "That's okay," he said. "No apology necessary." She was carrying a pile of books in her arms. She dropped them on the kitchen table. The photo albums. "Sit down," she said. "I'm going to tell you everything about me." And that is what they did. They sat in the kitchen and she told him the story of her life. He already knew most of it, but he'd never heard it all in one piece like that, from the very beginning to the end. They looked at the pictures. They read the old letters from Charlie. When she was finished, she said, "Now you know everything. Now I have no secrets from you. You know it all, from beginning to end." "Not quite to the end," said Smith. "There's still a bit more left." They were married on July the 10th. There were only 20 people at the ceremony, but most of the town came to the reception. Many of them were kids that she had taught. They held the reception in the school gym, Smith's idea. Dave gave the toast to the bride. He said the nicest things. And oh, the dress. Margaret finally agreed to go shopping in Halifax. She got the ivory suit from the lady who did the pearl detailing. Well, she didn't exactly get it. Winnie and Bernadette did. Winnie said it was perfect. Bernadette agreed. Margaret thought otherwise. "Makes me look like one of those real estate ladies from the city." She said that to Dave one night on the phone. "I'm sure you look just fine," said Dave. And he was right. She did look just fine. But she never liked it. And so, on that Saturday, on their way to the church as they were driving down River Street, Margaret turned to Dave, who was driving her, and said, "Pull in there and park." Dave glanced at his wristwatch. Margaret frowned at him and said, "You don't think they'll start without us, do you, David?" Dave knew better than to answer that. So he parked Smith's truck, which he was driving, and he followed his mother into Rutledge's hardware store without saying a word. Margaret winked at Dave as they marched up to the counter together. "Sandy Rutledge," he heard her say, "how much for that wedding dress in the window?" She paid $29 for the dress. Tax in. She changed in the staff washroom. They were in and out of the hardware store in under 15 minutes. When they pulled up to the church, Dave put his hand on his mother's arm and stopped her from getting out of the car. He smiled at her and he said, "I'm happy for you." Margaret said, "Me too." Smith threw his head back and laughed when he saw Margaret in the dress. He was beaming as she walked down the aisle on Dave's elbow. Winnie and Bernadette looked horrified. But they got over it. How could they not? Margaret looked radiant. She barely left the dance floor. She danced with all the young men she had taught all those years ago. And she danced with Dave and with Sam and Arnie Gallagher and Rodney McDowell. She even danced with Smith, who told her when they had finished dancing that he loved her dearly, but that would be the last time he'd ever dance with her. "Or anyone," he added. "Never again," he whispered in her ear. She just laughed and kissed him on the cheek and whispered, "We'll see about that," as he left the dance floor laughing. She danced the night away. It was her wedding, after all. She'd already had for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, in sickness and in health. This was the part that she had given up on. This was happily ever after. Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. I want to thank our special musical guests, Margie Carmichael and Catherine McClellan. Thanks also this week to Rod Snedden and Phil Bullpit for the technical assistance. David Amer is the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. Meg Masters is the long-suffering story editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. I'm Stuart McLean, and we're going to get Margie Carmichael to do one last song. So long for now.
This is probably the saddest story I've ever heard about someone who was not an islander. My name is Hector Jelly, and this is my complaint. Me twin brother is an islander, but holy smokes, I ain't. I was born aboard the Ebby Waite, and I came as quite a shock. But some idiot cut my umbilical cord before the ferry docked. Well, my younger brother, Borden, he loves to rub it in that he's a native islander and I the distant twin. I was always Tonto, he was always the Lone Ranger. He got out of the cuddly names, they just called me Stranger. So is it by default, or is it by injection? Is it come by honestly, or is it an infection? Won't someone tell me please before they put me in the earth? How in the name of God do I become an islander? Well, I loved a girl from Carleton, and she said she'd be the wife. A third generation islander, I'd known her all my life. But you called it off the night before and then phoned me up to say I could never tell a child of mine that his daddy's from away. Well, in my long and lonely later years, my prospects looked so cruddy that I dug deep down for the truth in the Institute of Island Studies. The experts said that when I'm dead, I may lie in a family plot, but even genetically qualified an islander, I'm not. So is it by default, or is it by injection? Is it come by honestly, or is it an infection? Won't someone tell me please before they put me in the earth? How in the name of God do I become an islander? Well, at 95 I finally died and I went to the pearly gates. Surely to God, by now I thought I'd found my rightful place. But St. Peter said, nah, Hector, I'd love to let you stay. You know, heaven's full of islanders, but you're still from away. Well, the devil saw me coming and he licked his lips with glee as he thought of all the torture to inflict eternally. But God yelled down from heaven, "Ah, be gentle, Lucifer. Hector's been through hell already, trying to be an islander." So how in the name of God do I be reincarnated or modified? How in the name of God do I become an islander?
Hello, you've been listening to The Vinyl Cafe. Stuart McLean and the Vinyl Cafe Orchestra are on tour right now, making stops in places like Montreal, Huntsville, North Bay, Sudbury, Chatham, Mount Clemens, Michigan, Indianapolis, Indiana, Cleveland, Ohio, and Seattle, Washington. In December, Stuart McLean and the Vinyl Cafe will be out on the road again, this time taking their annual Christmas concert across the country. You can find out more about all of these shows on vinylcafe.com.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.